On October the 7th, 2023, Israel was caught by surprise when a number of Palestinian factions united and executed an assault on southern Israel. Israel's subsequent response has seen global public opinion turn against it and face the prospect at the International Court of Justice over a likely genocide. As Israel now bombs Lebanon, there is a lot we still don't know about October the 7th, and there remain many questions on motivations, goals, and the positions of all the different players. In today's podcast, we want to unpick this all. Here to help me do this is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. Adnan, it's crazy that it's already been a year since October the 7th. Why did Hamas carry out this assault on October the 7th, knowing there would be a brutal, brutal Israeli response? What drove and motivated them to carry out this assault?
Okay, Yusuf, yeah, you're right. It's actually quite shocking. It's been a year already. Obviously, for the last year, we've just been witnessing the horrific images of what's been going on, the brutal bombing of everything that moves in Gaza and even beyond now. And I'm sure we're going to discuss, it looks like the war is really now spreading beyond a historic Palestine as well. Now, why did Hamas carry out the attack? I think this has actually been something that Zionist propaganda has also been pushing, that Hamas knew what the response would be. Why would you do something like that? And then the natural knock-on effect from that is these guys are just mad. They're military. They just wanted to commit mass murder. And I want to mention here the U.S. Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. He actually said last October, soon after October 7th, he said, and I quote, "It is important to also recognize that the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum, and the Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation." So for a lot of people, October the 7th is the starting point at looking at this conflict, and that's absolutely incorrect. This conflict is decades old. This conflict really goes back 100 years, actually. It goes back to 1917. With the British occupation. It goes to 1948 with the expulsion of the indigenous people. It goes back to the wars that happened in 1956, in 1967, in 1973, and even since then, the subsequent Israeli, as they call it, mowing the lawn. So really, anyone who looks at this from October 7th, they are part of the problem. They're not really part of the solution. And this is what the General Secretary of the UN was trying to explain here, that this didn't happen in a vacuum. Obviously, the Israelis accused you of anti-Semitism. How dare you try and provide context to it? How dare you try and provide some sort of context to what's actually going on? So, you know, Hamas, Yusuf, they produced a document in January. So a few months after October 7th. It's called Our Narrative. You can find it online. And in there, they actually go through what actually drove them to do it. And they talk about the history of the occupation, the fact that they are living under brutal conditions. And this is really what led them to do what they actually did. So really, we got to put October 7th into context, that the people of Gaza were in a living hell. That was their context. So they're under occupation. They've been under occupation for a very long time. And they were trying to break the status quo. And I'm sure there are lots of examples we can refer to in history where people under occupation tried to break out. The conditions Hamas were in, the conditions the Gazans are in, this has got absolutely little coverage around the world. Really, for everybody, the assault by the groups from Gaza, what they did and what happened and the deaths, that's the beginning point for everybody. And if you look at this conflict, Yusuf, every time there's an uptick in violence, that point becomes the beginning point. No one looks at the context beforehand, what was actually going on. So what motivated, what drove them, is they were living in hell. Their situation was one of brutal occupation. And when you are in that scenario, you're going to try and train the status quo. And that's what they tried to do.
Adnan, but what about the fact that Israel was always going to respond in such a brutal way as it has done? Should this not have been a factor that they took into account before they actually carried out the assault on October the 7th?
So, Yusuf, if we look at the context on the eve of October 7th, let's look at the situation on October the 6th. The regional Arab nations were busy normalizing relations with Israel in the Abraham Accord. So if you live in Gaza, if you live in the West Bank, you are hoping, expecting that the surrounding countries will come to your aid. Because they do say that. If you look at the Jordanian leader, if you look at Erdogan, they always talk about Palestine. And what they're seeing is these countries are normalizing relations. So famously, Netanyahu said the week October 7th happened, that this is the most peaceful the region ever be. The famous last words in the end. The people of Gaza, Yusuf, they were living a real nightmare. And a number of people, including Norman Finkelstein, have said that Gaza was a concentration camp. That was the reality of the people there. And even if you put that aside, Yusuf, the people of Palestine have turned to the global community. They've turned to international institutions. They've turned to Western nations. They've turned to peaceful protests. They've tried to even negotiate. All of this has fallen flat. Each time they do this, they don't get anywhere. The UN gets in the way. Israel gets in the way. The West don't actually do anything. So really, they were looking at why would you do this? Because the response is going to be brutal. What other option did they have? I mean, I'm not justifying the action they did, but this was the context at the time. And one of Israel's former military generals, Yusuf, he said after October 7th, and he said that, what do you think would happen if you keep a people under military occupation? They will rise up. So even Israelis understand that this is going to happen if this is how you treat people. So they've tried every other option. Every time they tried it, they've been brutally suppressed. Every time they tried to even peacefully protest, they are violently put down by Israel. The global community has failed them. International institutes have failed them. The surrounding Muslim countries have failed them. So this is what they resorted to in the end.
As we mentioned earlier, we're coming up to a year since the October the 7th attack. What was the strategy? What do we know now that we didn't know back then? And what were they looking to achieve?
Okay, so we've not really heard much about this, Yusuf, because the last year, the headlines have largely been dominated by the Israeli narrative. And I think this is important. Hamas have put out what their plan was, what their strategy was. They've even produced a document called Our Narrative, which you can find online. And what we know now, Yusuf, is this strategy was 2 years in the making. It didn't just come out of nowhere. It was around 2 years in the making. And their plan was to target Israel's military presence in the south of Israel. Their plan was to target the military bases there. And their plan was to take hostages in order to use them to free Palestinian hostages. So there's over 1,000 plus Palestinian hostages. Or when we say hostages, Yusuf, these are people that have been effectively kidnapped. There's no recourse to a trial or any legal order. So they're effectively kidnapped and they're hostages. So the plan was is they will kidnap Israeli military personnel and potentially civilians and then use them to free Palestinian hostages. So just on that point, Yusuf, it is not in their interest to kill the hostages. The whole idea is to ransom them off to get Palestinians freed because this has been a big push by Israel. That their plan is just to brutally kill them. But as we know now, that Israel has actually killed more of its hostages than it's actually saved. I feel that's an important thing to keep in mind. So in the end, Yusuf, they attacked around 8 bases around Gaza, and they were able to take about 350 hostages. We now know that 10 groups came together. They were able to unite, they were able to plan, and they were able to execute their assault. So they got around 15 miles into Israel, which you could argue isn't a lot. But in the context of Israel's brutal occupation, its apartheid system, that actually is quite shocking and quite unique. Actually, they were able to do that. And they were able to surprise Israel. And that's why Israel's initial response, they were shocked. They couldn't believe this was actually going on. And they caught them on the back foot. Israel never expected this. They didn't even believe this was actually possible. So what the Palestinian factions were able to... People keep saying Hamas did it, Hamas did it, Hamas did it. There were 10 groups, really, that actually did it. So that was their strategy, and that's what they were trying to do.
Looking at the Israeli side, I mean, there's a lot of ideas of why they performed so badly. Why did they actually not see this coming? Do you have any thoughts on that, Adnan?
Yeah, so for already the... investigations have started into this, but because the war's still ongoing, the results of these investigations, we won't really know until afterwards. Generally, Yusuf, the Israelis investigate every war, every uptick in violence, and they're actually very brutal in their own assessment of how they perform. So historically, they've actually been very, very brutal on how the IDF performed. So that's something we find out in time. What we do know, Yusuf, is that the Israeli officials were warned in advance about the attack. So the Israeli Security Forces Gaza Division commander, he actually gave a presentation to the leadership of the security service in July 2022, where he presented Hamas's detailed plan. So through their intelligence, they got hold of this plan. But the Israeli military, the Israeli intelligence and the political leaders, they dismissed the plan. They just didn't take it seriously. They just thought this is like really like beyond the capabilities of Hamas. We now know that Israel has spotters in the villages and towns around Gaza. So this is normal civilians, and their job is to monitor activity going on around Gaza. So obviously, if there's going to be an attack, there's going to be a movement of people. So these teams largely consist of women, because these are like people who live in villages. They actually reported to their leadership that they were seeing a lot more training and a lot more exercise and a lot more movement going on. And in the end, the movement they saw is what the Hamas executed. But Netanyahu and his security services believed that they had nothing to fear, because basically there's no way Hamas had the capability to execute this. We now also know, Yusuf, Israel had repeatedly been warned by Egypt's intelligence that something big was likely to happen. And in fact, even 24 hours before it happened, the Egyptian intelligence were telling them that. So when the Gaza groups did launch their attack on the morning of October 7th, the majority of the Israeli army was in the West Bank, not in Gaza. Gaza, Yusuf, if you look at it, it's a high-tech concentration camp. You've got fences, you've got a lot of technology, which is what they use to maintain the occupation. This is different to the West Bank. In the West Bank, because it's a larger area, you need to have your military there. So most of Israeli military is actually in the West Bank, because there's a lot of the towns that are close to each other. There's a much more larger population. So when October 7th kicked off, there's only a small amount of the armed forces there. So if the groups from Gaza were able to do a surprise attack, Israel would get caught on the back foot. They would need to really get other forces to really come there in massive numbers. And we also now know that Israel is actually getting ready to do a bigger assault in the West Bank to take more land, which they've done now. So because they were gearing up for another operation, mostly army was in Gaza, and they were satisfied that the high-tech concentration camp would go, that would be sufficient to deal with Gaza. This is why, Yusuf, it took time for Israeli officials to work out that the attack on October 7 was more than... Because what you find, Yusuf, is the groups from Gaza, they do fire rockets regularly into Israel. Israel doesn't take them seriously. So it took them a bit of time to work out this is more than a normal attack. So what we also now know, Yusuf, that a number of towns were overrun by the groups from Gaza. A number of military bases were also overrun. A lot of equipment was rendered unusable because the groups from Gaza made sure that equipment couldn't be used. And that's why, Yusuf, Israel very quickly was forced to turn to the Hannibal Directive. The Hannibal Directive is a doctrine Israel has, is something they've learned, that if they lose Israelis, they're going to be used as hostages to free Palestinians. So Israel has this doctrine that if we get to a point where we're overrun, we will fire even if Israelis die. That a dead Israeli is better than a captured Israeli. So they were forced to resort to this. In July, Yusuf, a couple of months ago, the IDF presented their first investigation probe into the battle in one area, the Kibbutz Be'eri. So this is the first detailed investigation of the many battles that took place on October 7th. More of these are going to happen. This investigation concluded that the army's colossal failure is what enabled the massacre. So it's a very, very brutal investigation and conclusion. However, Yusuf, looking at the resources Israel has, looking at the capabilities they have, once they got their act together, they were able to leverage their resources and firepower, and then they were able to reverse what was going on in Gaza. So that's why you find, I think in total, the whole thing must have lasted for about 8 to 9 hours. And the first few hours, Israel was really caught on the back foot. So from an Israeli perspective, this is how things turned out on the day.
So would you disagree with some of the ideas coming out where people are saying that Israel knew it was going to happen and they let it happen because they wanted an excuse to go into Gaza?
Again, Yusuf, we're looking at this a year down the line, and I'm not saying we have all the information. There's a lot of stuff we still don't know a year on, and there's probably information we're going to find that will probably change even some of the stuff I've mentioned in this podcast. Obviously, we can only go with what we know at the moment. There are some question marks. Even former IDF soldiers, former generals have questioned how this was possible. They've mentioned that the technology Israel has, really, it would have seen this from a mile off. That there must have been some serious shortcoming for this not to actually happen. Look, Israel doesn't need an excuse to invade Gaza. Gaza is a concentration camp. They regularly bomb it. They can go in. They don't need an excuse to do that. So I don't think Israel let this happen when they need an excuse. The fact that it's a concentration camp, is occupied, that's reason enough for them to actually do this. Really, Israel was gearing up actually on October 6th for normalization. Their view was, in fact, Antony Blinken and Biden were criticizing Netanyahu that the normalization talks have to include discussion about Palestinian state. And then Netanyahu would complain, why are you talking about Palestinian state when none of the Arab rulers are talking about Palestinian state? They're just talking about normalization. So Israel doesn't need an excuse to go in. And obviously in the end, they did go in. But yeah, there are still a lot of unanswered questions, which probably in time will become clear.
Okay, since October 7th, obviously we've seen the brutal, brutal response of Israel. Could you tell me more about their strategy? Why have they gone in so brutally?
So as a couple of days after October 7th went by, the world obviously realized something big had actually happened. Israel really, you know, went into fifth gear straight away. What Israel effectively did, because global sympathy was with Israel, term you've heard regularly, this is the largest number of Jews killed since the Holocaust. So they're linking it to the Holocaust. This is an equivalent act. So they effectively used the global sympathy, really, to respond. And what you find, Yusuf, straight away, the response, largely you find it was genocidal rhetoric. There's so many quotes, Yusuf, that I'm sure we're all are familiar with, calling them human animals. You got Netanyahu, who made reference to a biblical story about Amalek, what happened to them. You've had other officials who said there'll be no electricity, there'll be no water, there'll only be destruction. And you even had one official say this is Nakba 2.0. So, you know, this is what got them in trouble, really. This is why they're at the International Criminal Court. This is genocidal rhetoric. So this is one of the ways they responded. We see, Yusuf, on October 27th, then, we saw the ground invasion of Gaza. By the end of 2023, Israel, Yusuf, had dropped 29,000 munitions on Gaza. This is, I think, even more than Dresden and some of these World War II wars. So they've destroyed over 70% of the homes in Gaza. And what you find, they've left no stone unturned, Yusuf. Hundreds of cultural landmarks, cemeteries, mosques, churches, refugee centers, hospitals, none of them were spared. We find even the safe areas where they told people to go, even they've been bombed repeatedly as well. We've also seen Israel create a man-made famine by blocking humanitarian aid to Gaza. Just this week, Yusuf, the State Department's two agencies who deal with American aid and humanitarian aid into Gaza, they said that they've written reports which were given to Antony Blinken that Israel is stopping aid going in. So this is a man-made famine. So that's why this week there's been calls for Antony Blinken to resign. Over 42,000 Gazans have now died. And over half of these, Yusuf, are women and children. So that's really been the key pillar of their strategy. And then also we see the propaganda war was launched immediately in parallel as well. I'm sure when they discuss it, the propaganda war, the information war, has been a complete and utter failure.
How has Hamas responded to this? Was this something that they were expecting?
So yes, Hamas obviously have been in war with Israel for quite some time. They were naturally expecting there's going to be some sort of response. So since Israel assault on Gaza, what Hamas has done is they began a guerrilla war. They've been carrying out ambushes and using improvised bombs to basically make life hell for the IDF soldiers that are invading Gaza. Hamas is still able to strike Israel because they only use a small portion of their resources on October 7th. So you find most of Hamas's top leadership, Yusuf, is still intact. And thanks to Israel assault, Hamas is actually more powerful, more popular in Gaza today than they were at the time. And according to many analysts, if we use the measures that matter, Hamas seems like it's actually stronger today than it was. And this is from other analysts as well. So what Hamas is doing is effectively using the tactics that we saw in Vietnam, the tactics we saw in Afghanistan. When you're fighting another power who's more capable, what you do is you do guerrilla warfare. You work in small teams. There's no center or gravity. And what you do is you attack their supply line. And that's what they've been doing really since then.
You're claiming that Hamas is now even more popular, especially in Gaza, than it was pre-October the 7th. Don't the people of Gaza actually blame Hamas for the realities that they face now?
So no, they don't. Because the people of Gaza and Hamas are the same people. Hamas are also people of Gaza. And they, members of Hamas and the Gazans, they have been living in a concentration camp for decades. They're in it together. And as far as they were concerned, everything they've tried has fallen flat. So what you've seen is none of them have turned against Hamas. In fact, it's brutal what's happened since then. But Hamas is from amongst them. Hamas isn't some foreign entity. Hamas isn't some foreign leader who's been flown in. Hamas and the Gaza are the same people. And that's why they're more popular today. And this is something actually recognized. So Netanyahu keeps saying that one of our objectives is going to destroy Hamas. And Israeli official after Israeli official, Israeli military leaders keep coming out and saying there's no way you can destroy Hamas. Hamas is an idea. And Hamas is an idea that's indigenous to the people there. Hamas and the people of Gaza are not some separate entity. They are one people, really.
Adnan, you mentioned Israel has lost the information war. Why has that been the case, considering all the resources at their disposal and all the resources of America as well?
Yeah, so this has been really surprising, Yusuf. You know, for decades, I remember Israel has dominated the airwaves. The Israeli opinions about everything dominates public opinion. Very hard to get alternative views. But I think it's quite simple. What people are seeing is very different to what Israel's telling them. And people can see it now. We're in the era of social media. We don't need to go to Sky News and BBC to get information. We can go to other sources, which are much more neutral. And literally what Israel's saying, what people seeing is the complete opposite. So what we're hearing from Israel is that she's acting in self-defense in Gaza. Its objective is to free the hostages held by Hamas and to reestablish order and security by destroying Hamas's military capabilities. And it keeps saying that it was doing this in the most careful and humane manner possible. But what they've been doing is they've been collectively punishing the population of Gaza. And what they've been trying to push is this must be accepted because it's necessary to destroy the power of Hamas. But what everyone saw, Yusuf, was the complete destruction of Gaza. What they saw was hospitals being bombed. What they saw was churches being bombed. What they saw was children being bombed. So as a result, this self-defense narrative and then also the do you condemn Hamas narrative is failed to take hold completely. In fact, Yusuf, what I'm finding online is even journalists who are on the Israel side, they look silly if they don't question some of the facts that Israeli officials present. And that's why you find a lot of these Israeli spokesmen, they keep getting sacked because they're doing a really poor job and they're being called out by even neutral journalists as well. So Israel's military leaders and intelligence, they keep saying Hamas can't be destroyed. But this is all you're hearing from Netanyahu. So I just don't think Israel ever prepared for the day where they say something and they get questioned. They're never prepared for the arguments that people question them with and how you refute them. They're so used to they say something. We did it for national security. There's Hamas members in a tunnel. There's Hamas members in a hospital. And they just think everybody accepted this. The moment people have started questioning them, they've struggled. So they went into a hospital and there was a poster and they said these are names of people that they want to kill. And it transpires in the end, it was actually a rota for the doctors that worked there. Now, how do you come back from a lie like that? The famous tunnels underneath Gaza, where are they? Why can't we see any pictures? So what people are seeing and what Israel is telling them is completely different. And also, you know, for a lot of people, even people who believe Israel has the right to defend itself, they are saying Israel's gone too far.
Adnan, I wanted to get your views on some specific points that Israel has made and what do we know? What do we actually know about them? So number one is that Hamas has deliberately targeted civilians.
So this follows on from the argument that this October 7th assault, it saw the largest number of Jews, it saw the largest number of deaths since the Holocaust. So by linking it to Holocaust, what they're saying, it was genocide. So the number of people that passed away, what they're saying is that there was no military objective here. There was no defensive objective here. This is just mass slaughter. These guys are just bloodthirsty. And that's why loads of civilians died. The problem here is there's been investigations by Israeli media companies, by neutral people. And what we're finding is that just doesn't hold up. So in an investigation by the Hebrew newspaper Haaretz, they concluded almost half the people killed on October 7th were in fact combatants. They were soldiers or police. They found that there were no recorded deaths of children under the age of 3. And this is important, Yusuf, because if they talk to civilians, how come over half of the people weren't civilians? What that would indicate is they were targeting military personnel. Now, we know also that Hamas targeted and attacked military bases. These bases are around towns, so they obviously had to go through the towns to get to some of these. So naturally, civilians would have got caught in the middle of it. The most famous example was the Nova Music Festival. We heard that there was a music festival. I mean, a music festival going on next to a concentration camp, that's probably a discussion in itself. But there was a music festival going on, and we actually now know that Hamas have actually admitted that they got caught off guard. They didn't even know. Why would they know there was a music festival going on? They only saw there was a music festival going on. So they actually thought, Youssef, that they're going to be outnumbered because you've got a massive number of people at this music festival that went on for the whole night. And you've only got a certain number of fighters who are going there. So obviously there are many videos online, but a lot of these videos also show the music festival, Youssef. There's shootouts going on between Hamas and the other groups and armed Israelis. And you've got civilians who are caught in the middle. And there's even testimony on this that there's Israelis that you were saying, we weren't shot by Hamas, we got caught in the middle. Because obviously what you find, some of the Gaza groups were dressed in military uniforms, others weren't. So a lot of Israeli military officials were saying when they turned up, when they arrived, they couldn't work out who's Hamas, who are the militants, and who are normal civilians. So what you find, Yusuf, the evidence doesn't stack up that the target was civilians. Now, civilians were caught in this. Civilians did die. There may have been individual cases where civilians were deliberately targeted. But to say Hamas specifically targeted civilians because they're bloodthirsty, the evidence actually points to the opposite.
Okay, Hamas has been accused of committing acts of sexual violence.
So this is probably one of the key claims. There were a lot of horror stories that came out after October 7th. These were directly from people who are apparently there. And then we had a lot of the Israeli media and the international media pick it up. And even Joe Biden at one point read this as well. The allegations of mass sexual assault, they are accounts by survivors. They are accounts by first responders who found dead bodies. And they had concluded that these bodies or these people were sexually assaulted. One of the main investigations was in December 2023. It was a New York Times, they did an in-depth investigation and they published their findings in an article called A Scream Without Words. And in it, they accused Hamas of raping women, of gang raping women. But subsequently, Youssef, it became known that one of the writers turned out to be a former Israeli spy. And actually, many of the narratives and the report details, nobody else was able to collaborate it. The final thing on this, Youssef, is a lot of these allegations come from a group called Zaka. It might be Zikash, I'm not sure I'm saying it right. So this is a voluntary religious organization in Israel. And when there are deaths in Israel, this group, their job is to get the bodies and do the burial according to their religious rites that they have. So what tends to happen is when there's a mass assault, this group are usually the first people to get to the dead bodies. Now, it was subsequently found that they didn't handle the bodies. So these are not guys who are investigators. These are not guys who know how to handle forensic evidence. If you move a body, you're tampering with evidence. So what came to light subsequently is they didn't handle the bodies correctly. In fact, they moved them around and they contaminated them. And what we also now know, this organization was actually on the verge of insolvency before October 7th. And one of the co-founders, he had actually just resigned before then due to allegations of rape and pedophilia. So this is not a credible organization. To be taking their testimony, to be taking their accounts, there are serious question marks. What we also find, Youssef, is this group actually made a lot of false reports in the end as well. So all the investigations, Youssef, into sexual violence, we find that most didn't look at any forensic evidence. What many did is they looked at bodies, the bodies were injured, and they said they must have been actually raped. That's not evidence. The best case of this was there was a UN work group set up to go and investigate this. And it was unbelievable. She gave a conference and she said that using reasonable doubt as a principle, sexual violence took place. And then someone asked her, did you see any forensic evidence? She said, no. They asked her, did you speak to any survivors? She said, no, because Israel didn't give us permission to go and meet them. So on what basis are you saying sexual violence happened when you've not got any forensic evidence and you didn't speak to anyone who's a survivor? So probably one of the most famous cases, Youssef, was the girl who was found dead and her underwear was around her knees. And the first responders who got to her body, they said she had been raped. But later it was confirmed by further investigation that the body had actually been dragged and moved by Israeli soldiers. So when you move a body, you've contaminated the evidence. So Probably the most recent investigation we've seen is in June, so the Times published a detailed investigation, and it basically said that Israel's claims about the scale of sexual violence, the fact that it was sanctioned by the Hamas leadership, the fact that it was systematic, they actually conclude this doesn't stand up to scrutiny. So a year on, there's a lot of question marks over this. Now, I'm not saying it may not have happened. I think there's some individual cases where it probably did happen. I don't have any evidence for that, but obviously it was a situation where these things can happen. However, the argument from Israel was this was systematic, this was the goal. For that, there's no evidence.
There's been accusations of mutilation. Have we got any evidence for that?
So these allegations, Yusuf, they center around the bodies that were found that apparently were beheaded, and there were burnt bodies found, and Hamas is accused of doing this in order to mutilate them. Now, again, Yusuf, a lot of these allegations, they come from the Zaka organization that has no credibility. Many of the allegations were spread by Israeli officials, which unfortunately even Joe Biden, the American president, and Blinken quoted. When Biden quoted this and he said this and he was followed up with evidence, the American official tried to deny that that's what he actually meant. The Intercept, the online magazine, the investigators, they called into question the credibility of many of the testimonies, especially as many of the testimonies were based on the New York Times Scream Without Words article, which itself there's question marks over. We have to take into account that the accounts from the Israelis, you have to keep in mind that a lot of the carnage was because the Israeli helicopters were called in. They fired on people. We have testimony from pilots who said they didn't know who was Hamas, who wasn't. We know the Hannibal directive was put into account. So many potentially could have died because of the actions of Israel. And in fact, many Israelis have actually said that was actually the case. Also, Yusuf, there's a question we have to ask here, that many, many homes and many, many vehicles were burned and heavy equipment was used. We know that Hamas and the Palestinian group, they used light armor because they had to move. Mobility was the key for them. So they didn't use heavy armor. The only people who could have used heavy armor and they implemented the Hannibal directive was Israel. So there's a very good possibility here, which many people are saying is probably the case, that a lot of the mutilation could have actually taken place by Israel, not on purpose, but because they were caught on the back foot and they were responding.
Adnan, this is one that was peddled a lot very early on and it still continues now, the beheaded babies.
Yeah, so the claim that came out very early on was the 40 beheaded babies. Again, Yusuf, the original report comes from the Zaka organization, which I mentioned before, they've got no credibility. The 40 beheaded babies has been traced back to an Israeli reserve settler and a soldier called David Ben Zion, who he's previously incited violence and riots against Palestinians, and he's called for the West Bank to be wiped out as well. There's question marks over that, but also no evidence has ever been presented or produced to support these. What we have is the allegation. What we have is Israeli officials saying it. What we have is many people repeating this. We've never actually seen actually any evidence. Israel's information war, it went into full swing after October 7th. Many accusations were thrown at Hamas and the Gaza groups. More or less all of these, Yusuf, have no evidence and they've been discredited a year on.
Let's look at the global response. Why can't US stop Israel and force them to make a ceasefire deal?
It's been very interesting, Yusuf, this year, looking at how Israel operates, looking at what Netanyahu has been doing, and looking at America's response. And what we can see is America, so this is Biden, this is the White House, this is State Department, this is Blinken, this is the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, this is the CIA head. They disagree with what Israel wants to do. They put pressure on Israel. And then Israel engage, and for somehow America manages to see the ration and the logic to what they're saying, and then America comes on their side. So this begins from initially when there was going to be a full-scale invasion into Gaza. And literally every week, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, Lloyd Austin would fly out. They sat in Israeli meetings and they managed to stop the full-scale invasion. In the end, effectively, Israel did what's called a surgical operation, which is quite interesting because the surgical operation seems to be worse than a full-scale invasion. Quickly, Biden started talking about a ceasefire. He started talking about day-after plan. Netanyahu dragged his feet and he said, until we don't destroy Hamas, until I don't bomb Gaza back to a stone age, we're going to continue doing this. Again, American officials kept going out and Netanyahu kept not listening to America, continued doing what he's doing. Even when Biden criticized Netanyahu that too many innocent people are dying, too many civilians are dying, he's continued doing it. What we find is, despite all this criticism from Israel, from America to Israel, by all these American officials, America has still been providing arms and equipment to Israel during this period. America has been providing long-term equipment, and it's also been providing ordnance and these heavy bombs to Israel as well. And what we're seeing is that the defense industry want these arms to go to Israel. They keep saying that Israel needs to defend itself. We need to help Israel defend itself. So we need to provide these. So even when Biden believes Israel's gone too far, what you find is there's other officials in the state, or there's other officials in the political system, they believe we need to keep supporting Israel. So what's actually happened is the American president's hands are tight. There are people in the government, there are people in the state, there are people in Congress. They believe it's in America's interest that we support Israel. Despite Israel becoming a pariah, and despite Israel looking really bad on the international scene. And if you look at the Israel lobby in America, if you look at the defense industry, which is intertwined with the Zionist project, if you look at the evangelical Christians who support Israel, all of this has effectively handcuffed the American president to respond in a different way. And I have to throw in, Yusuf, it was election year. In election year, you don't want to be seen as the anti-Israel prime minister. If you want to win the election, for a chunk of the American population, Israel is part of domestic policy. So Biden, Kamala Harris, and Trump, they have to be seen to be pro-Israel. So we have this scenario where the global superpower is effectively being held hostage by another nation. This is why America has not been able to stop Israel and Hamas. And it remains to be seen, does this change after the election's over, after November?
What about the other Western nations, the UK? I mean, I know recently it has stopped the sales of some of the arms they're sending to Israel. What do you make of the UK?
So, I mean, not just the UK. If you look across the West, we've got this interesting scenario. The people want restrictions on Israel. The people can see what Israel is doing. But the political leaders and the elites of these countries, they keep coming out saying Israel has the right to defend itself. We're going to support Israel. And as the pressure's grown, as the protests keep happening every week, what they're doing is they're doing these token actions to show the people, look, we're on your side. So we take the UK as an example. The UK has around 350 export licenses to Israel, and they stopped 20 of them. So, you know, it was as good as doing nothing, really. In Germany, I was surprised the amount of military equipment they were providing them, and they've continued providing it to them. So what you find is, and you've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, Britain created Israel. The Western countries see Israel as their forward base in the Middle East, so they're going to defend it. And that's what they've been doing. But the difference now where they're doing this, despite growing public opposition against this act, and this is the problem we're getting to now, where the masses now, even in the West, they see Israel as the problem, and they want their leaders to represent that sentiment. At the moment, the political leaders and the public, they're not on the same page. So that's been a very, very interesting development. That means that this support Israel had with no limits, now is, you know, restrictions, people want to see restrictions on it.
Let's look at some of the Muslim nations and how do we make sense of their response. So if we go through some of these countries, Iran, first of all, who is the country that has supported Hamas?
So if we take a bit of a step back, Yusuf, most of the Muslim rulers have verbally in the past supported Hamas. Iran says they support the Palestinian, issued the Palestinian calls. Erdogan doesn't stop talking about the Palestinian calls. The Egyptian, Jordanian, Saudi have said they support the Palestinian call. They support the two-state solution. So now the Palestinian people, it's the time of need. Now they need you to actually deliver. Not just words, they now need you to physically deliver on these promises you made. And overall, year on, Yusuf, what we find is the Muslim rulers have not gone beyond the words. They've not physically actually done anything. It's still been fighting words, which is not what you need. In your time of need, Yusuf, you really learn who your allies are. And who the allies the Palestinians believe they had, what has become clear now, they're not really your allies, but they haven't done anything to help. So if we take Iran, Yusuf, Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated in July, he visited Tehran a week or two after October 7th. And when he visited, he met Ayatollah Khamenei. And Ayatollah Khamenei said to him openly, you didn't inform us of this attack. We aren't going to help you. You're on your own. That's what he literally said. Iran criticized Israel's attack on Gaza. It kept saying we support the people of Gaza. And the only time it acted, Yusuf, was months down the line when Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Syria, Iranian consulate. That was when they acted. They didn't do anything when the Palestinians were being massacred. So that's quite telling where they really stand. We see the same thing with Turkey, Yusuf. Erdogan has made his career out of supporting Palestine. And when it's come to the time of need, he's nowhere to be seen. Again, a lot of fighting words, but he hasn't done anything to physically help. What's interesting, Yusuf, is I was just reading last week, Turkey's trade with Israel has gone through the roof, has gone up during this period. So rather than boycotting, the trade has gone up. The other interesting thing is most of Israel's oil, it comes from Azerbaijan. And the oil from the Caucasus has to go through Turkey. And that's all been going to Israel during that period. So even the advantages Turkey has that it could use, it hasn't used them, which is very telling. Egypt and Jordan, I think they've not hidden what they're up to. When Netanyahu proposed that the Gaza should go into Egypt, they should go to the desert, the Egyptian leader, Sisi, didn't want to take any of them on. In fact, what Sisi's done is they've made sure the Gaza border's closed so the Palestinians can't actually come there. And Jordan, when Iran launched missiles and drones at Israel after the consulate was attacked, Jordan played a role in shooting down some of these actual missiles. Egypt and Jordan are very clear what side they're on. They're on the side of Israel. They're on the side of the West. Saudi Arabia, Yusuf, they've been more keen on restarting the normalization talks. So for them, the Palestinians don't matter. And this week, in an interview, MBS has openly said that I don't really care, but my people care. So unfortunately, I have to care about Palestine. He's more concerned about normalization. So the Israelis are saying, let's put normalization on hold for the moment because look, there's a war going on and it's not good for you. And he's saying, no, I want to continue normalization. So for him, Palestine doesn't even matter. In the past, Yusuf, Saudi did hold some of the tools for the two-state solution. They used to openly advocate supporting the Palestinians. But since MBS has come in, he's made it clear he doesn't really care. It's not an issue for him. And in fact, what he's effectively said is, I don't need to even support Palestine. It's not really an issue for me. And I don't need it for my position. The Muslims globally, they are all in shock, in horror. They have been doing protests. They are all with the people of Palestine. In fact, the sentiments of the people, the global ummah, is on the complete opposite side of our rulers. They are not on the same page at all. And that's the situation, really, unfortunately, a year on.
One country you didn't mention was Yemen. Obviously, we've seen some support from Yemen. What do you make of Yemen and their capabilities as well?
So Yemen, who is part of this axis of resistance, so these are all the Iranian-backed groups. What they did is eventually they started targeting ships along the Red Sea that were going to Israel. They have also fired a couple of ballistic missiles at Israel as well. Now, what's interesting with the Houthis in Yemen is their priority is domestically. They are in a civil war with the regime. They take over areas of Yemen, then they actually lose it. And they've taken over the state now, and they've got a problem now because Yemen is in severe poverty. They're unable to provide basic resources to the people. And as this was going on, they mobilized their society to focus on a foreign issue, on a global issue rather than a domestic issue. Because on the domestic side, they've been a complete failure. In fact, the people have had enough of them because they've taken over the state and they're unable to actually change the situation for them. So what it seems, Yusuf, what the Houthis have done is they've mobilized their society that we are now involved in a regional struggle and that needs to be the focus. So get behind us and we all need to work together. So that's really what's going on there. What they did in terms of firing at Israel, I think they fired two ballistic missiles and they've targeted a few ships. The scale of this has been so small, it's just a dot really. On what's actually going on. And that's the capability they have. They can't really do anymore. So although they got a lot of media coverage, all of that media coverage was really misplaced. Really, there's only so much they can do. They're so far away. And the frequency and depth of what they can do just isn't enough really to hurt Israel. What the Houthis do for the West is, this is spreading. So we need to get more involved. We need to send our army to the region to stop a regional war. So they've used the Houthis to justify to their population why they need to be there.
Recently, there's been an escalation with Israel launching a war now on Lebanon. What do you make of this, Adnan?
So, Yusuf, today, as we know, this podcast is going to go out a week down the line, but Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, he was assassinated today. So this has really escalated. In fact, what's happened in the last week is the war effectively shifted from Gaza to Lebanon. Now, this has been on the cards for some time. After October 7th, there was a fear that if Hezbollah opened up a front in the north of Israel, this would overstretch Israel. Israel would have to divide his armies. But what Hezbollah did was they were quite contained in what they did. The border between Israel and Lebanon, there's a whole area around his border, which is the buffer area, and the area is disputed where the border is. So because Hezbollah was firing into this area, around 60,000 Israelis were moved from the north of Israel, and they were put in temporary accommodation. And that's what allowed Israel to focus on Gaza, not having to worry about the north. And their plan always was, we would deal with the north later. So in August, an Israeli official said that by September, when the school year starts, we need to deal with the south of Lebanon. We need to deal with Hezbollah so these people can go back home, because it makes the government look bad. So that war they've now started now. And what Israel effectively is saying is 18 miles from the Israel-Lebanon border to the Litani River, they want that to be a buffer zone. So their argument is the same as Russia's. Russia's saying the area we've taken over Ukraine, that should be a buffer zone. Israel's using the same argument here as well. It's like the French saying nobody should live in Dover because we want that to be a buffer. That's what they're arguing. So what Israel's doing is similar tactics again. They are bombing indiscriminately despite saying they're targeted. So the attack on the pages, Yusuf, that was the beginning of this war on Lebanon. What they effectively did is they used the pager attack to disorient Hezbollah, and they launched their attack basically under this. So what they've done is they're bombing the south of Lebanon. They're bombing in Beirut now. In fact, they're bombing even the northern areas. There hasn't been the only response from Hezbollah has been that they launched a missile against Tel Aviv, which was intercepted. And you're going to remember, Yusuf, Israel has always said that every 5 or 10 years they need to mow the lawn. They need to carry out a strike to weaken Hezbollah. So that's where we are now. And really, in many ways, war is now in Iran's side of the coup. Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated in Tehran. The head of Hezbollah has now been assassinated. So Iran needs to respond. Hezbollah is under attack, so they need to respond as well. So we'll have to wait and see how that happens. But what's interesting, Yusuf, is there's no conservatism from Israel. Israel's not saying maybe we shouldn't do this, maybe this should be regional escalate. In fact, Israel wants this to escalate because it means it can weaken its enemies. And it knows even if it gets stuck, America will be forced to come and defend it. And because of this, they keep pushing the boundaries. They keep doing risky things because America will have to come and defend it. Why does America have to come and defend it? Because America has invested for several decades in Israel. It is a forward base for America. America doesn't want that investment to go down the drain. So the Israeli leadership have realized this and they take advantage. So that's why, from a military perspective, it doesn't make sense. Why have you gone to war in another place when you haven't even finished up Gaza as well? But the Israeli view is this is an opportunity we've got and we're going to take it. And there's a good chance, Yusuf, America might come down on them hard after the election. So Netanyahu's probably worked out, I've got another month and a bit where I could probably get away with this, cause damage, and then I'm probably going to have to enter into negotiations. So he's thinking, I might as well get this all done now.
What do you think? Do you think Hezbollah have the capability to respond and really save themselves?
So Hezbollah and Yusuf, they have a very capable arsenal of missiles. They potentially can use this, which will be a big problem for Israel. They haven't for the moment. It's been, nearly a week. So they're still quite restrained. If Israel invades, then they've got some advantages. So that's something Israel's going to have to consider. Up until now, Yusuf, you know, Hassan Nasrallah made it clear, you know, we're not going to get involved unless it expands. Because of that action, now the war's come to his doorstep. So he's gone. They've got a new leader now. And I still think they're acting in a very restrained way. They still haven't completely opened up and gone for it. Now, there could be other calculations they take into account for that. But if they had opened up a front, Yusuf, a year ago, they would have overstretched the Israeli military. They didn't, and now the war's come to their doorstep.
If we go back to Gaza, how do you see this finishing? Do you see an end to it? Is it something that will come soon?
Well, the end, Yusuf, is the dystopian picture that we see, where you just see rubble, you see mangled infrastructure, you see people sitting on the streets. There's no electricity there, there's no water. It is already finished, really. Israel's bombed it back to the Stone Age. All the talks about the day after, what you find is Israel still wants to play a key role in the security. There's talk of Israel actually having a road that goes through Gaza, which they will maintain, and that's how they're going to try and secure it. So what Israel's talking about is the Gazans can come back, but we are going to play an even bigger role than before October 7th on maintaining security. So they don't want the Gazans to have their own security. They want to do the security because they can control what they're doing. So effectively, this is more than even a concentration camp that they have as well. This is what they're proposing, but all the proposals for day off, Netanyahu's been able to drag his feet, and America has not brought to bear the influence it has over Israel to bring them into line. They've generally ended up agreeing with Israel and actually supporting them in the end. So I think when this does end, it will be Gazans can come back to their land, which is just all rubble. There'll probably be some agreement with the Gulf countries investing in Gaza for reconstruction. But Israel will be even more heavily involved in that region. So the occupation will probably get worse.
Final question for you, Adan. What does the outpouring of support for Palestine in the West now mean? What are its implications going forward in the future?
So this is very unique, Yusuf. In the West, generally, public opinion was for Israel. But this is changing now. The Generation Z, they see Israel for what it is. They see it as genocidal. And they want their politicians to now represent that. So now you see a lot of criticisms on the politicians. You still say Israel has the right to defend itself. Joe Biden just today said that the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah is justice served. And everyone's just thinking 41,000 people have died, completely disproportionate. You didn't say a word that you said Israel has the right to defend itself. So what you're finding, Yusuf, is the dominance of pro-Israel public opinion is now changing. Many people who are neutrals feel Israel's gone too far. There are still protests going on every week in the capital cities of the West. There are still sit-ins at many universities. The divestment campaign is still going at full throttle. So what you're finding, Yusuf, is a year on, despite everything Israel's done, the rubble they've turned Gaza into, the high-tech pager attack they did, the brutal bombing campaign they're now doing in Lebanon, the stealing and seizing of land in the West Bank, a year on, Israel is neither stable, neither is it secure, neither are they going to sleep thinking now we're in an advantageous position. At the same time, Yusuf, brand Israel has taken a major, major hit. The support Israel had, the credibility they had, really has taken a major hit. And this is what I mean when I say they've lost a propaganda war, the public opinion. In fact, Israel, I would say, Yusuf, is a pariah state today. Apart from the Western leaders and the elite, the masses see Israel as the aggressor. And the fact that Israel is at the International Criminal Court being accused of a genocide, let me put this into context for you, Yusuf. The people who were the victims of a genocide are now on trial for perpetrating a genocide. This is the world that we live in today. This is the situation.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. You impact a lot of things on people's mind. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com. Thank you for listening.